Hi.
Hi. Hey, I brought you something. Again, two podcasts in a row I've brought you something.
I know, I've got nothing for you.
A copy of this year's Booker Prize winner, Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders.
I will put that with my other two copies of that book. Give it to another deserving friend because I do. Hey, do you remember getting this book? Like, I got it sent to me ages ago.
Yep.
And it arrived. So, like, the book is, it's got quite an interesting cover. This is the soft cover. I don't think it came out in hardcover. It's by George Saunders, hottest writer in the world right now. And it's covered with these testimonials like Jonathan Franzen. He makes the all but impossible look effortless. Zadie Smith. He'll be read long after these times have passed. Thomas Pynchon, an astoundingly tuned voice. How do they find Thomas Pynchon? Isn't he a recluse? Doesn't he like live in a like dumpster somewhere? So like this guy is such a brilliant writer that Thomas Pynchon has come out of retirement to endorse his book. Like that'd be pretty awesome as a writer, wouldn't it? Like Thomas Pynchon called. Very interested in endorsing your book.
Who's like very reclusive God. That would be awesome to have come out to
Howard Hughes.
Howard Hughes.
Is he dead?
He's probably dead.
He's got to be dead. By the way, I'm rereading that book Hoax, by the way, at the
moment.
Oh,
yeah, you love that.
I love that book. It's just like this one that I go, it's just so good by Clifford Irving, his account of writing a fake autobiography by Howard Hughes and how it all just came just gloriously publicly unstuck. He ended up.
That sounds good.
Yeah, anyway.
So the reason I'm giving that to you is because I'm keen to get it off my hands because I found it impenetrable.
See, this is the thing. I felt this flash of just guilt and culpability when I heard that it had won the Booker Prize because I started reading it. I didn't dig the structure, and everybody I know thinks it's a work of genius, and I'm sure it is, but I think I didn't really try hard enough with it. Anyway, now it's won the Man Booker, so I'm going to have to go back and read it again. I also listened to his podcast that he did with Richard Feidler, by the way. Which is really interesting. But it still didn't really make me want to read the book. I just like, what's wrong with me? What is wrong with me? Because this is obviously genius.
Well, what's wrong with me also? And, yeah. Because everything you said, I found exactly the same. Yeah. It's sort of, to me, it feels a bit borderline like some sort of old school, like it's poetry-like, it's sort of Greek literature-like.
Wow, you're really selling. So the thing that I remember about it is that when it turned up, you know how now publishers do all these like things to kind of pique your interest with a book? Like they send out like a press release and...
Like a Ferrari with it. That always exactly. catches my interest. Yeah.
And this one, because the front cover is... it's got a sort of hole in it that where you do a peeping into the next... next cover. I don't know. I've explained that badly. There's also a design of ivy twining
nice
around
cover.
It.
Yeah.
Well, when I got my original sort of promotional copy, it had plastic ivy
so did mine,
wrapped around it.
Which was annoying.
Which made me so angry because I was just like, ah!
Same.
Thank you. More landfill. You know what? It's just a book. Maybe the book could just be book.
Well, I bet the publisher who sent us the free copies of this book's really happy with that investment.
Totally. Right. I mean, they could have...
Given the rap we're giving
they could have had it, you know, arrive in the G-string of a dancing girl and it probably still would have paid off. But, like, I just think it's so weird that this sort of book promo stuff, like you get little sort of... you know, novelties and things. And you think, mate, my view is if you need a novelty to make me be interested in this book, it tells me that the book isn't very interesting. So I reckon, to be honest, that my kind of slight disinclination about this book is totally tied back to the fact that it arrived covered in plastic leaves.
And I just wonder as well, would...
And also, by the way, I am never going to complain about the fact that people send me books. It's probably because of this podcast and, like, being in the media. That is a, like... With daylight second, the greatest thing about my job is that sometimes people send me books.
Well, I was actually going to raise this and say, would it be better if publishers simply emailed people to say, hey, these are the books we've got coming out this month, bang, 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 bang. Which of those books would be of interest to you to look at for your program or your podcast or whatever?
Well, the only thing that I would say about this, and I again just like to note that this is an incredibly privileged and lovely position to be in because really, like, it is... my lifelong dream to have this happen. So
yeah, have one of these crackers with caviar on them.
Yeah. Enough caviar sales. I'm sick of caviar. Smash. Damn it. Why does the world suck so much? I do like, I have actually picked up books because they've been sent to me that I would not choose off the shelf, and they've been awesome. So, like,
yeah,
that is a pretty great thing, you know, to, and I think if I was left to self-select, then I would probably only select books that I think I'm interested in, and I'd never be surprised.
Hey, speaking of what I would self-select that was sent to me and it is awesome, there's two new collections of Helen Garner's work that have come out, and the design is so beautiful.
No way, really?
I didn't know that. One's fiction and one's non-fiction. It's just collected works, and the design of them is identical, but one covers red and one covers blue, and it's very sparse. Just an amazingly beautiful design cover. I'll put a photo of them up. They're just absolutely gorgeous. And I should probably, because we never do it, plug. You can visit our website, www.chat10looks3.com. You can find us on Facebook, although someone has to invite you, don't they, to be in the group in Facebook?
I think you,
you can apply.
You can apply.
Yeah.
And really,
we've got
we're
a low
not
bar.
Really knocking anybody out.
Unless you unless
my name
your name
is A Murderer. Sure, come on in, A.
And on the on that page, there's all sorts of useful resources, including dates and links to live shows that we're doing around the country. I think there's
no tickets left for Canberra. Sorry.
Canberra sold out, sorry.
But there's still some tickets left in Adelaide.
There are, Adelaide.
On the 9th of February.
That's right.
Come and watch me taunt sales about being from Queensland. And then later in the year, I have to go to Queensland.
I loved. Yeah, that's right. We're going to be, the tickets aren't on sale yet, but Brisbane in May, Perth in September, Orange in late May, because we wanted to do a regional show to show you regional chatters that we care. That's all. That's
oh, the Enmore on Hobart.
The Enmore in Sydney in June, and the tickets are on sale for that. So if you had a good time at the show in Sydney in that we just did, come to the Enmore June show. I love how you did some publicity in Adelaide, where I wish I had it here to read aloud, but you said something like, you know, sales. I'm really looking forward to bringing sales over to Adelaide because she's from Queensland, so she's not used to things like
the finer things in life, like wine that comes in bottles
and people who wear covered footwear in restaurants. You're such a bitch. You're such an asshole. Oh, speaking of assholes.
Oh, yeah.
I watched Assholes at Night, Our Souls at Night, the film version of that, which...
So this is this book that sales is crazy bibliotherapist, hold me while I cry a little
Jermaine,
person.
Is not crazy?
No. Okay. So she said, why don't you read this book about this elderly couple who start sleeping together for company?
And I really liked the book. It's by Kent Harriff, and a film version came out with Jane Fonda and Robert Redford, which I had some issues with.
Because they're
casting.
The type that would each be old and alone.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I had a few problems with it. I know you're supposed to suspend disbelief with, you know, make-believe worlds, but there's no small town in America that has two people as good looking as Jane Fonda and Robert Redford in it.
And like you're Robert Redford living in a retirement community and you're not just covered with naked pensioners 24/7. Like, can you imagine if Robert Redford were like moved into your elderly kind of village accommodation? Everybody'd just be like,
totally.
Oh.
And if two people as good looking as Robert Redford and Jane Fonda did live in the same small town, for the past 10 years, they would not have been able to leave the house without somebody saying to them, you know, you should go out with Jane Fonda. Anyway,
but the other problem that the film has encountered is that they've held on to the book's title, Our Souls at Night, which in a written form is lovely and tender and kind of evocative of this spiritual connection that they share, but the American producers of the film worked out as soon as they released it in the UK that over there people pronounce it Our Souls at Night, which is what's happening here too. So Our Souls at Night is the name of this film now. It's just like been this huge backlash with people just going, which is not supposed to be the response that you have to this tender and it's not touching film.
It's not a comedy, all right? Oh, man.
I just want to say that I said that first.
You did.
I was just like, mate, you can't say assholes at night.
You were the first person to demonstrate the sense of humour of a 14-year-old boy. Somebody's actually written an article about this now, I think, about the phenomenon of being called.
Just remember who said it first.
What have you been doing?
Heaps of nothing. I've been doing, because I'm on leave from the ABC, so I am just pottering around doing like school canteen duty and doing lots of cooking. I made the smuggest bunt of my career.
Wow.
A couple of days ago. I'm working on recipes for a new cookbook, so it is just like the definition of fun, like just hanging around. Hanging out with kids, making food. Some of it works, some of it doesn't. But the smug bun, oh, Lord, it worked a treat.
What was it?
So I made a brioche sort of dough, so like a yeasted sweet dough, and I rolled it out into a rectangle, and then I spread it with dried apricots, which I had soaked in apricot nectar with a bit of rose water. So it becomes like a really chunky jam. Spread that over. And then I made pistachio marzipan, listeners. Yes, I did.
Ooh.
Okay, so there is like the international marzipan scam is almost as bad as the like cartridge toner for printers scam, I reckon. Yeah. Because like it's really expensive to buy.
Right.
And the supermarket marzipan is not great either. So if you want to buy really top shelf marzipan, you are really paying out for it. It's really easy to make.
Oh.
So it, all it is.
What, yeah, what is it?
So you just get like blanched almonds and icing sugar, like whiz it into a powder, and then add an egg white. Bingo.
Is that all it is?
That's all it is.
I bet your Brenda can do that in her Thermomix.
Yeah, I bet she can.
In that cult that she's in.
Yeah. Jeez, I don't know about that cult.
She's in two cults.
She
is. Ours and Thermomix.
Yeah. The thing I will say in defense of Thermomix is that it does make really, really good stock. So if you like, don't spend the $3,000, just make friends with somebody who has a Thermomix. Oh. In my life, that's Gwen. And every now and again, she just brings me a jar of what she calls baby poo. And it is the Thermomix paste stock. So it just takes, like, you put a carrot, I don't know, a number of carrots, a number of, you know, celery sticks and some garlic and onion and whatever. And the Thermomix sort of weirdly zhuzhes it and then cooks it down so it's a paste, and then it's the greatest vegetable stock ever. Like it's there's about a kilo of salt in it too. But
so what do you if it's a paste, then what do you do? Put water in it? Just add water or something?
Well, so if you've got a pan of like I now, if I cook pasta, I'll put a tablespoon of this stock in, and it just improves the taste of everything. You know, rather than cooking pasta in just salted water, you cook it in stock, and you know, bingo. Or if you're making like minestrone or something, instead of like you just
So instead of putting in like vegetable stock, you put water and a teaspoon of this stuff.
Yeah, correct. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It's really good. Oh, anyway, okay. So make friends now with Brenda for the baby poo supply. Where were we? Oh, yeah. I'm just going to dismount from my smug bunt story.
So we got distracted. So
there's a rectangle of brioche dough rolled out, and then there's apricot. And so I've made pistachio marzipan, which is just 150 grams of pistachio kernels, 150 grams of icing sugar, and then like, this is awkward, but about half an egg white in the food processor. And it's suddenly, it's this sort of stiff dough, very pliable.
Wow.
Very workable, because it's like really thick icing basically. Because if you think about it, it's just like icing.
Yeah.
But with nut meal in it, and it's this beautiful green color. So like rolled it out very thinly to a rectangle the same shape as the dough, lay that over the top, then roll it all up so it's a sausage, and then you kind of slice the sausage along its, you know,
length.
So you split it almost to the end, leave the end a bit joined so it's like a pair of jeans.
Yeah.
And then kind of twist it around into a ring.
Circle.
And then so you've got like bits of apricot peeping out and bits of marzipan.
Yum.
Yeah, it worked out really well. And then I made I just sort of brushed it with some apricot jam so it was all nice and shiny.
Yum. And did it taste beautiful?
Yeah, it did actually.
Yum.
It tasted really good.
Awesome.
I can give you a bit to take home with you if you want.
Is it going to make it into the recipe book?
With a bullet, ma'am. Yep, it's there.
Very good.
But also, what else have I been doing? I've been to see lots of things. Last night I went to see the Wharf Review.
Oh, yeah.
Which is – it's been running for about – I don't know, nearly 20 years now in Sydney. So the Sydney Theatre Company once a year, like it's like their run up to Christmas. They put on the Wharf Review, which is written by Jonathan Biggins, Drew Forsyth and Phil Scott. And each of them is like massively talented, but in a different way. Biggins is an absurdly good mimic. So he can do – his Keating is just extraordinary. They've all got great voices. Drew Forsyth has got this incredible bass voice, and Phil Scott is incredible on piano.
Brilliant.
He used to have that show, Three Men and a Baby Grand.
He's amazing.
Anyway, he's amazing. They're all, and they usually have a collaborator most years. And this year it's Blazey Best, who's like a great Sydney actress who turns out to just have this amazing voice. Mm. And she does, you know, Julie Bishop and Michaela Cash, you know. And anyway, there are some just scream with laughter moments. It's very funny if you like political satire, and they are so professional that it's really polished. Oh. But the funniest idea, I reckon, in the show, because it's like a series of sketches, it's really fun night out, because it's, you know, it moves really fast, and they are all such great performers that you never get this sort of like, oh, this isn't really working kind of thing. But because they are all doing quick change, they have like a big video screen where they have like a few kind of little video sketches just to sort of get them enough space to get their, you know, Julie Bishop outfits on and whatever. And there's this little series that they do a couple of over the course of the show called press briefings from history. And the first one is Biggins dressed up as Louis the 16th, and he's like he's just like doing a press briefing to the French press. And what you don't realize for the first 30 seconds but then becomes really clear is that he's doing it in the style of Trump.
Oh,
so it's like
classic.
You know, I have so many castles. They're such beautiful. Some people say it's the finest castles in the world. I have, you know, incredible. So many rooms, you know. I have so many guys. I am like the top French guy, you know. And he's doing it in this great accent, and he looks hilarious, but it's all about being like Trump. And
classic.
Trump's kind of patterns of braggadocio and kind of ultra, ultra, you know, self-assuredness come through. The next one is Vlad the Impaler.
Oh,
like doing
God.
That. It's so funny.
Oh,
and then
great.
Elizabeth the First, you know, it's God, it's such a simple but brilliant concept, and they've executed it perfectly. But the other thing that I'll say is that Biggins's Trump is just so good.
Wow.
So good. He's amazing. And he scrambles into the outfit really quickly, but Biggins is a great physical comic, you know,
right.
And it's one of the best Trumps I've seen.
Speaking of good mimics, I'm a gigantic fan of a guy who's a cabaret performer, Sydney-based, called Trevor Ashley. My friend George and I always go to every show that he does, and he'll often do tribute shows to people. So he did Liza Minnelli a few years ago. He does sometimes musicals, like he had one which was sort of Annie. It was a takeoff of Annie, which he originally called, because his name's Trevor, it was Tranny. But then there was some issue and they had to change it to Little Orphan Trashley. But he just finished a Barbra Streisand tribute show. It was absolutely fantastic. And just watching him, like the degree of difficulty of her songs is so high. But he did it absolutely fantastically. But he shared this anecdote that George and I are amazed by, which is Barbra Streisand has a sister named Rosalind Kind.
Really?
Who is
imagine being Babs's sister, like all your life. You'd be like,
well, wait for this. Also a singer.
No.
Yeah. And Trevor has talked about being
I think
in
she
New
should
York.
Just be in property or something.
God, like, just be a kindy teacher or something. Trevor talked about going to see her at a club in New York, and he said it was like going to see the best Barbra Streisand impersonator you'd ever seen in your life. He said she looked exactly like her. And even down to the fingernails, you know, Babs has, you know, the sort of classically, you know, the sort of fingernails that you have claws.
Yeah, you have to like hold a mic like you're wearing another mitt. She's just like, oh, I'm just more of a peg than a person, actually.
So it was. He said it was uncanny. So of course, George and I immediately beetled home and Googled Rosalind Kind, and it was freakish. But even so, I just went down in the most ridiculous YouTube rabbit hole. So then I found a show that where Barbra actually sang with her sister Rosalind in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Oh God, it was so awkward because Barbra said something like, you know, finally the opportunity you've always wanted. It was awful. But then the song opens with Barbara's just sitting down, and she's wearing this cape-like thing. She's sitting down as if on a throne, but Rosalind has to stand.
Oh, no.
It was like everything about it was just absolutely diabolical.
What's the bit? There's another sister that's just been locked in the basement for, you know, and can sing like a bird.
Oh, man. But
no
I want to go.
Hears her.
It was interesting listening to Rosalind Kind because she definitely did sound and look a lot like Barbra Streisand. If you hadn't heard Barbra Streisand sing, you would have thought Rosalind Kind was a really great singer. But it's just like,
God, that's crushing. Don't say that. God,
it was just like about, it was about the 60% Streisand. It wasn't quite there. So, but yeah, it was unsettling.
I'm actually feeling a bit sweaty and uncomfortable.
It was. Let's that move is what on. I was like. But I really want to, I want to see Rosalind Kind now. I thought it was amazing.
You read anything?
I'm not reading anything because I'm doing a really bad thing, which is I've allowed some TV watching on my iPad to replace my book reading in the evening because I've been binge watching a show called Billions.
Now, I'm sure you've told me this before, but I've let it wash over my head because I'm just like not interested in sales.
I'm absolutely loving it. I don't think it probably would be your bag. It is Paul Giamatti and that unattractive redheaded guy from Homeland. That I'm one of the few people to find unattractive. Lots of other people find him attractive. His name? His name is Damian Lewis.
So it means nothing to me.
Damian Lewis. They are – it's set in New York. Giamatti is the state's attorney. Damian Lewis is a businessman, somebody Axel Rod, called Axe, who's a venture capitalist.
No, go on.
And Giamatti believes Axe is corrupt and is trying to bring him down. Mm-hmm. Complicating matters is that Giamatti's wife is a psychologist who's on staff with Axel Rod, and her job is basically to get the traders into the frame of mind so they're whipped up and they can make money. Mm-hmm. Now, I appreciate on paper that sounds sort of not that exciting, but it's awesome.
Just to recap, it's it stars a guy you're not really that into, and it's about property deals.
Yeah, but Paul Giamatti, I think, is a god. I think he's the most amazing actor. And Damian Lewis, I mean, he's good. But the thing that's tricky is, I said to my friend who put me onto it, am I meant to be rooting for Giamatti here? Because they're both, you know, Axel Rod probably is corrupt. Giamatti is one of these people. He's like a zealot for the truth and for rightness. Yep. But he'll pretty much do anything. You know, he's got no sort of like, oh, you've accidentally implicated your parents in this shonky deal. I feel sorry for them. No. They're implicated, they're gone. So he's quite an unsympathetic character in some ways, whereas Axel Rod actually is a quite sympathetic character. So it's this interesting blurring of who's the goodie and who's the baddie.
Oh, okay.
But the dynamic with the wife I absolutely love because she is the sort of in-house psych in Axel Rod's finance company. She's very close to him. And so they have this unique, he's almost like, it's not codependency because she's not dependent on him, but he's very dependent on her.
Right.
But they're not in love or anything, or that's obvious at this point. He seems quite in love with his wife. But Giamatti is very jealous and possessive of the relationship that the wife has with the redheaded guy. So, yeah, there's lots of different layers in it. Everyone's acting is fantastic. The scripting's really tight. And there was a great scene at the end of season one where, you know, sometimes where you have those series where there's two great characters and then the climax is that they sort of meet and they have their big engagement.
Yeah.
And so there's this climactic scene where it's maybe 10 or 15 minutes of them having this exchange.
Oh,
and it was,
I love that.
Just, they were both just at the absolute top of their game. And you felt
just
like...
acting up a storm.
They were. you felt like... I thought it was the best I'd ever seen Damian Lewis. And I just thought, I can't help but think that's because you're getting to bounce off Paul Giamatti.
Oh, you're just not going to give him an inch, are you, this guy? What's he ever done to you?
Did you like Sideways?
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
I haven't seen it for a long time, but I remember thinking... it's always stuck with me, the scene where he busts the Pinot Noir or the Merlot or whatever it is in the McDonald's or wherever he is at the end.
Yeah. What reminded you of that?
Because Paul Giamatti's the lead.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah. I haven't been reading. I've just been. Have you been reading?
Yeah, I have. I've been. I'm reading a book called The Choke at the moment.
Oh, yeah.
Sophie Laguna.
Yeah.
Really liking it.
Yeah.
It's. I'm in this really weird pattern at the moment. I don't know how I got in it, but every book that I read is about. It's told from the perspective of a child.
Oh.
And like in that kind of atonement style where, you know, it's the child is now an adult but like sort of telling the story through their memory of being a child.
Which is, yeah, okay.
I mean, it's a hard thing to pull off, but some people do it really well. McEwan is amazing writing, you know, through the eyes of a child, and Atonement's a really good example of that. And some of his more kind of dark, disturbing work, like The Cement Garden, and are really good examples of that. And I sort of am in this sort of – every book that I read is like that. And The Choke is about this told from the perspective of this girl who's grows up in country Australia, and she's been brought up by her grandfather because her dad is like this mysterious truck driver who comes and goes, and she's got two stepbrothers. Her mother abandoned her when she was little. So it's like this sort of hard scrabble existence with her two brothers and fights with the neighbours. And anyway, it's all going somewhere and I haven't got there yet. You know that I read The Strays while I was away,
yeah.
Which is also that sort of a bit of awakening sexuality and all that sort of thing.
Right.
But I read this book that actually is along those lines as well, called Demigods, which I think really just tips over the edge into just silly. It's by Eliza Robertson. It's an American book, and it's plugged as a debut novel for fans of Emma Klein's The Girls, which is me.
Oh, yeah.
I really liked The Girls.
Right.
But this is like what's happened with this book is it's really savage, right? It's really there's some real like kind of violence in it, and the story is about this girl whose mum kind of remarries, and the new husband's son is this quiet, disturbed boy with whom she has some sort of weird codependency, and he ends up just doing dreadful things to her. And over the course of the book, as she gets older, you know, periodically reappears and is just like a real jerk to her and does like really like torturing her, and like it's just by the end of it, I was just so cross because I think – and I also – I blame that a little life a little bit for this, where there is this thing now where people put just wanton violence into their novels and it becomes like an art form to think of like terrible things that people can do to each other. And it's like the it's so graphic, you know, and I think I kind of blame that book a bit for this boundary being pushed. Is that fair? Probably not.
As you know, I have sort of strong views about that.
That's why I raise it. I feel like I get a sympathetic here.
Yeah, you've got a sympathetic audience here. I just think, does it advance the plot? Like, is it necessary?
Yeah, I ended up putting this book down because I was just like, ugh. You know, like, they're really, I mean, the writing is fine. It's just, I just don't understand. It seems to me that some of the violence and graphic content is there for its own sake, you know, and I think that that's not, that there's no, I couldn't really understand like what the idea was about why this woman was still continue to be drawn to this guy, you know.
Maybe fits with what we were talking about last episode about that woman in Dirty John, and you know, why people are attracted to people that from the outside you go, that's a mystery to me.
But I mean, you know, there are redeeming features or there are kind of emotional reasons why you're, you know, drawn back. There's really none of that in this book at all. Anyway, I don't know. It made me think of this thing that I always, you know, when somebody writes a big sort of original or incredibly successful, like smash hit novel, you know, that's great, then the worst thing about it is knowing that there'll be this whole kind of, you know, flock of things that are in the tradition of that book that kind of don't work as well,
well
or whatever.
Like me the other week criticising Ozark TV series and saying it was like some TV producers said, I need a Breaking Bad. Somebody get me another Breaking Bad. And so it's just like a poor man's Breaking Bad, you know, with good people in it. It's fine, but it's just like, yeah, okay, I see what we're trying to do here. Yeah. It's the regular suburban guy with the seedy underbelly life with the drug dealers, blah, 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 blah. Seen it done better, you know.
I wonder if Dickens had this problem. Oh, you wouldn't know, would you?
Not caring about Dickens. Well, I'm happy to note that our time's nearly up.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
I've got lots of other things to talk about because, you know, I've been going and doing different things. Oh, hey, I went back to the White Rabbit.
Oh, yeah, that we went for our TV show, yes.
Yeah, which is this great little gallery in Chippendale in Sydney. So if you come to Sydney, definitely drop in. It's one of these, it's set up by this kind of fabulous art philanthropists, basically, who it's free to get in, it contains the proprietor's kind of collection of Chinese art, but then there's like really great exhibitions. They turn them over pretty quickly, and the one that's there at the moment, as ever, is like a collection of different Chinese artists, and there are a couple of really impressive things. And because it's like they're quite ambitious in the artworks that they load into that gallery. It's a very kind of tall, thin one, but they give over a whole floor to something quite extraordinary. And the extraordinary one on the third floor at the moment is that some artist has built out of bondage equipment like whips and corsets and, you know, whatever's, dildos and things. So it's all made out of black leather and studs, and it's like they've built a temple, and it's like it's 6 meters long by 3 meters by, and it's got like all these like minarets topped with dildos, and like it's less rude than it sounds. Like, you know, I took my 4-year-old daughter along, and she was like, "I'm just like,
oh, you might let her watch The Bachelorette."
Like, it's not sexy. It's just like black leather. It's like a castle. It's like a temple made of black leather. It's just like it's so. And it's sort of suspended on these ropes. It's huge. It takes up the whole room. But imagine you look at it and you just think, oh my God.
Imagine going to the tool shed and going, look, I need 35 dildos. Do you have like a discount for bulk ordering?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, exactly. No, I had my mother with me who's like, oh, dear. But anyway, it's incredible, A, the sort of scope of the vision and the fact that you would actually follow through on this, late-night drunk idea.
You know? I love that you consider a wonderful family outing for three generations of your family
is to go to a giant temple made of dildos. I didn't know that there was a giant dildo temple there, all right? But it was like – it was more about the temple than the, you know, bondage by the time they finished with it. But the other thing that was there was so beautiful and weirdly moving and the act of describing it is going to probably flatten most of the appeal, I accept that. But it's a darkened room and it's completely dark, and then the floor is painted like a high, high gloss black.
Right.
So you can see reflections. Right. And the artwork is about a dozen fluorescent tubes alight. They're just white fluorescent tubes. And they've got a cable on each end, so they're suspended like a trapeze swing, right?
Right.
But they're on some sort of like computer program that changes the position of the fluorescent tubes.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes they're all rising and falling together, and sometimes independent of each other.
That sounds beautiful.
It is so beautiful, and there is this lovely classical music playing, and the movement of the fluorescent tubes is attuned to the music. So
oh, that sounds
you
great.
Sit there and you let it wash over you. The music's beautiful, and the lyrical movement of these seemingly invisibly suspended light sources is just, I found it really moving.
Oh,
and
that sounds great. I want to go straight and
it kind of
it.
Reminds you of the bows of violins, because you see them moving and tilting, and then sometimes they become like, all of a sudden they're like a stairway. They're going up in stages, and then they completely reorganize themselves.
People come up with some incredible stuff, don't they?
It's just the sort of thing that you – and yet it's entirely engaging.
What about – did you see – I saw nothing except I saw the video. I don't know who made it, where it's from, who the performers are. It was a spiral staircase with a trampoline in the middle. Did you see this? And
no.
It's three men who are walking up the staircase, and then they jump onto the trampoline and then jump back onto the staircase. And they're sort of in like some sort of sequence. It's and the staircase is moving. It's like revolving.
Oh, my God.
It's quite – mesmerizing when you're watching it, and again the degree of difficulty of just the, you know, like juggling. It's almost like a human form of juggling.
Things
or something
that people come up with after a few beers.
It was just it was like it just reminded me of what you described, because it was like, wow, this just seems so weird, and yet I'm just like completely transfixed by watching the motion of it over and over again. Right, I gotta get out of here. I got right. places to go. I got people to see.
All right, see thanks ya. For the book. Take it with you when you go.
Just bin it.